Welcome to Lucky Paper Radio. My name is Andy, and I'm a merchant sailor in the early 19th century. I've been ashore for a little while, and to be honest, I've gotten quite bored. I was thinking I might try my hand at whaling, so I make my way up towards Nantucket, traveling by day and staying at inns every night. Tonight, I've arrived quite late, after night has fallen, at the Spouter Inn. Unfortunately, there are no rooms available, but the innkeeper assures me he knows of a patron that will be willing to share a bed with me. And he's a harpooner, no less. I'm shown to my room, but there is no sign of my bedfellow, so I lay down to fall asleep with no small sense of unease. Before I can calm myself enough to nod off, the door bursts open, and I find myself in the shadow of a hulking figure. My bedmate appears to be a tall, muscular man from the South Pacific, covered from head to toe in tribal tattoos. I'm uncomfortable with his dark complexion, because, like all people who lived in the 1820s, I'm a horrible racist. The man takes a step into the room, and his face is illuminated by candlelight. It's Anthony.
Fortunately, we're still getting a slight Wi-Fi signal through the Burger King.
How many things can we mash up into one thing? This is, you know,
I've always been told I look a lot like Queequeg.
I like to mark my seasons of life with whatever media it was I was most interested in at that time. And for me, this is the summer of Tyler, the Creator's new album. It's the summer I read Moby Dick for the first time. And it's the summer of just binging the back catalog of Bunta Vista, and this intro is the result of that.
Fair enough.
You're not much of a Queequeg. You've got a lot of good attributes. I don't think maybe you have the build for being a harpooner, necessarily.
Yeah, that's fair. Okay.
But Anthony, this is not an improv comedy podcast where we read internet articles and make fun of them. This is instead a Magic podcast where we talk about our favorite card game.
Is it Magic the Gathering?
Yeah, I just said it was a Magic the Gathering podcast. You're not even listening. You know that thing where you just... You know, we're having a podcast where we just talk at each other.
Correct.
We got to be engaged. We got to listen.
I'm checking my notes. I'm shuffling magic cards.
We have an evergreen episode all lined up for you today. So sometimes we like to tackle a topic that we think, hopefully, kind of only needs to be addressed once. I mean, a lot of things we're talking about are just our evolving sense of the game and new cards and how we're changing the design of our cube. But sometimes there's a topic that's kind of nicely self-contained. And this week is one of those evergreen topics. We're talking about the logistics of having a cube.
Yeah, it's not really just one topic. They're just these sort of like really basic is the wrong word, but logistical questions that come up with how do you actually just keep and manage a cube that I see come up like again and again on Reddit, on Twitter, wherever people are talking about cube and especially, you know, starting to build a cube. Mm-hmm. And I feel like we can just burn through a whole bunch of those and just answer a lot of those basic questions. So this maybe isn't the most interesting episode for the enfranchised cuber, but hopefully we'll provide some meaningful context and conversation about those as well.
Luckily, our personalities are so adorable and charming that I'm sure the most enfranchised cubers will still enjoy our conversation, Anthony.
So the first thing, if you're ready to just...
You're just diving right in. We're going to skip the listener-submitted pack one, pick one, because it is an evergreen episode, and we want to get right to the topic for potential new listeners. If you're listening for the first time, I'm sorry for the whole whaling thing at the front. That was weird, but sometimes we get weird at the beginning. So we're going to skip the listener-submitted pack one, pick one, but we're still doing that. So if you want to have your cube on Lucky Paper Radio, send a link, send your name, send your pronouns to mail@luckypaper.co. Anthony, right into our main topic at only 4 minutes. This is great.
Wow, amazing. We're going to get through this real fast. Maybe. So the first thing I wanted to touch on is, I think this is one of the most basic questions that gets asked when people are starting to build a cube is, how big a cube should I build? This is maybe a little bit touches on the design of the cube itself, but I think that a lot of the other little things we're going to talk about touch on how big your cube is. So it's worth starting there.
I agree.
And I think there's a lot of things that are kind of fluffy or contextual about what you might consider when making this choice. But there's one pretty hard rule, which is how big is your play group? Are you trying to play with a group of 8 people? Do you have 3 other friends that you're playing with consistently? You just need to have enough cards for those. So for most players, if you're trying to play with 8 people in a normal pod with normal 40-card decks, you're going to build at least a 360-card cube. If you're playing with a smaller group, it's totally reasonable just to build a smaller cube with just enough cards for those players to draft.
And especially if you're new to cubing, I always say that smaller is, I think, so much easier at the beginning for a lot of reasons. For a lot of logistical reasons we're going to talk about, for just getting over the intimidation of making your first cube, I think starting small is great. So I would definitely encourage anybody that's making their first cube, assuming you want to draft it with 8 people, start at 360. I know that the Magic Online cubes are all 540 for technical reasons. There's other even bigger cube sizes out there. And you can take solace in the fact that you can always make your cube bigger. Making your cube bigger is so easy. Making your cube smaller is hard because you got to make cuts. Making cuts is not fun.
I absolutely agree.
So always start small is kind of my advice for anybody out there. If you only got a play group of like 2 or 3 people, make a 180-card cube. Start there.
So I do want to touch on some of the reasons why you do want to make a bigger cube. And really, the core reason is just variation. If you end up playing your cube very, very often, if you're saying, I'm designing this cube, I know it's going to be played twice a week for the next couple years, then building a bigger cube just means you're going to get more variation between the drafts, where you're going to see different cards, have opportunities to draft different decks. So if you're looking for that variation, you can go as big as you like. We've seen cubes that are thousands of cards, but usually, you know, things are between 540 or 720 if you want to draft with a full two pods. So if you're looking for that variation, that's an option. Other things to consider, obviously, budget. A smaller cube is going to be cheaper, so especially, you know, starting out with a brand new cube, starting with the smallest list you can makes a lot of sense, as well as portability. If you're, you know, like me, biking around the city and you want to keep your cube in a bag and not have it be too cumbersome, smaller is another great win in that column as well.
So small is good. I would say just start small and then go bigger if you want to go bigger. It's much easier to just go bigger.
I want to make one other point about cube size, which is a lot of times people sort of focus on these sort of like balanced even numbers like 360 and 720 because that makes sense. It's nice. It's aesthetically pleasing. It's symmetrical. You know exactly the right number of cards for a certain pod. But I think there's also a huge advantage just to sort of having a few extra cards and having kind of a floating size. This is something that I did when I first, like pretty early when I was starting to design my own cube, I sort of settled on doing this of just keeping it like between 400, 430 cards. And the biggest reason is just it makes it so much easier to update. And I know myself, I know if every time I wanted to add a new card, I had to find a parallel cut, or if I wanted to cut something, I'd have to find something to add. I would not update the cube as often as I want to.
Mm-hmm.
So having this kind of floating size just means, hey, if they print a new card, I can just throw it in. Or if I'm, you know, finding a card has bad play patterns, I can just cut it. So make things easy for yourself.
Yep, I like that approach. I do keep a fixed number of cards in my cube because I actually kind of want that additional pressure of finding cuts. I think it kind of keeps me a little bit honest, but there's perfect reasons to do either approach. And if you're stressing out about getting down to your final cuts, just don't. Just start playing your cube.
Advantages to both. I feel like that's going to happen a bunch this episode, just like everyone.
Probably. We do say that quite a bit.
Next question that I see asked all the time is, how many basic lands do you need for your cube?
Should I just answer it?
Yeah, easy.
So people often think this has to do with the size of the cube. It actually doesn't at all. It has to do with the number of players you plan to draft your cube with. So if you only have a 540, but you're only ever drafting with 8 players, you just need enough basics for 8 decks. You don't need basics commensurate with the cube size. So for my cube, I have 40 of each basic, which I think is generous. And that's my cube is designed to be drafted with 8 players. So if you're looking for some kind of heuristic, you could say 5 of each basic per player. That's generous, I think. I think you can reasonably go lower. This also has a little bit to do with the amount of non-basic lands in your cube. I think when I first started my cube, I had a much lower density of non-basics, and so players needed more basic lands to fill out their decks. Now I have more non-basics in my cube, and I find that my 40 is extra generous and way extra than I actually need.
Right. So if we did the math, if you're doing an 8-player draft and you expect people to be playing 17 lands, you'd need about 34 of each just to have, like, literally enough basics for everyone to have 17.
That's assuming no non-basics.
That assumes no non-basics. That assumes no one's, you know, a bunch of people aren't in the same color pair.
Right, so it's an even color distribution.
But yeah, so I think even at that point, because there are so many reasons why people are not playing 17 basics in their deck, either because they're more aggressive decks or they include a lot of non-basic lands, I think even 30 is pretty generous. So in my own cube, I know in the first couple drafts we did, I have 30 of each basic. And in the first couple drafts where the cube was maybe a little bit not quite where I wanted it to be, we did run out of islands a couple times. And most recently, mountains have become pretty popular. So we're very close to running out of mountains in the last draft we did. But 30 has mostly been totally reasonable. I think also you should think about the context. If you're going to be taking your cube to a cabin in the woods where there isn't another magic card around for miles, then maybe be a little bit more generous and have plenty. But if you're playing at the shop and you have some extra sleeves, it's not a crisis to, you know, grab a basic out of the land box and sleeve it up.
Yeah, it's a really good point. If you are playing in your house or your local game store or something, like, your cube is never anywhere far away from a big pile of basic lands based on how our life tends to play out.
So how do you go about choosing the basic lands for your cube?
Is this a logistical question?
I think this is a really important logistical question we should touch on real briefly.
Okay, I think this is just you trying to troll me for my less readable basics, because you're about to say, well, I choose them based on readability and legibility on the board, because I'm a very reasonable person.
I just wanted to add a little spice here, but that's a great point.
So my personal rule for basics is I like my basics to look like lands, and I totally appreciate the modern art direction of Magic, where the interpretation of the different land types is a little more generous to allow them to tell the story of a plane or, you know, whatever. If you go to Ravnica, the swamps that look like swamps. It's just a dark city or a green city or a wet city. But I like my mountains, forests, islands, plains, swamps to look like, you know, mountains, forests, islands, plains, and swamps. And I also like old borders. So my cubes pretty much exclusively have old border.
And you like foils.
Foil, basic lands. And the era of the old border basics happens to be an era of the art direction being pretty straightforward. It's like, oh yeah, that's a mountain. And that's a bunch of trees. So you know it's a forest.
Yeah, I mean, this is obviously not the most critical part. You can play with whatever kind of basics you want, and it's going to work. I do kind of think it is fun, and a lot of cube designers do enjoy finding basics that fit the theme of their cube.
Oh, so, for sure.
Old border foil basics really fits the aesthetic of the rest of your cube. In my main cube, which is mostly modern border and sort of a low-key cube, they're just sort of, they feel like lands you'd find in your land box, but I chose specifically the illustrations that I enjoy the most from that, you know, consistent set of borders. For some of my more avant-garde cubes, I've gone a little bit more avant-garde with the lands and played all kinds of crazy
Turbo Cube is wild. You get some very turbo lands in the Turbo Cube.
But it's fun to bust out those turbo lands.
It is. I want to mention here briefly something I've seen some cube curators do, which I really like, is some people at the end of the draft let the person that 3-0'd, if there was a 3-0, sign a basic land.
I love that.
Which I think is a very cool way to give your cube some personality, have it tell a story over time, not have expensive cards be, you know, ruined by a signature of somebody who's not the actual, somebody who's not relevant to the card, like not the artist or something like that. And, you know, you're going to have, you know, I have 40 of each basic, so I have 200 basic lands in my cube. It's going to be a while before I get 200 full pods drafted to actually fill that out if I were to do such a thing. So I think it's a really cool way to add a little bit of personality and depth to your cube if you're into that kind of thing.
So 30 to 40 basic lands, pretty reasonable. You are welcome to go lower if you have a cube with a lot more non-basics, or again, it depends on the number of players. If you're designing a cube, no matter how big the cube is that's designed to be drafted with only two or four players, you need a lot less.
Yeah, and I actually go a little higher in mine just because I have the room in the box. I have the way I have my lands all set up. We'll get to storage, I'm sure, later. The way I have my lands set up, I have extra room in the deck boxes, so why not include extra lands and just give people more variety and just have extras in there? Who cares?
The next most critical part, arguably, is sleeves.
I think sleeving a cube is pretty universal. There's not many people out there playing unsleeved cubes.
I've heard of some, and I respect it, but I don't recommend it.
If you're a Magic player that's considering making a cube, you probably have some preference already for sleeves. So we can talk about the brands we use, but I mean, sleeves are sleeves. They pretty much work, and everyone has their own sort of preferences. So I'm not going to like hardline vouch for my particular brand or setup. What I will say is that Cube is unique in that it's a format where you are not playing with all the cards. You're handing the cards out to other people to play with them, and I think you might consider a different sleeving solution given that you're going to be handing these cards out to people you know, strangers, whoever, to play with, just because they might treat the deck differently than you would treat your pet EDH deck with your custom printed sleeves that you know to shuffle a certain way so you don't peel the art off or something.
Choosing sleeves with the expectation that durability is a priority. You're going to be playing these, you know, with different people. They're going to get played a lot, and you don't really get the opportunity to really baby them like you would with, like you say, your EDH deck that just you are going to be playing.
Yeah.
So to that point, I think also double sleeving is a thing that makes a lot of sense for a lot of cube designers. Again, this depends a lot on how valuable the cards are, how important maintaining condition is, and also if you just want to do that work, because it is a lot of work and not a negligible expense. But it's definitely something to consider, and if you are double sleeving, that does mean you probably want to double sleeve every card that's in the cube, as well as all your basic lands.
Yeah,
so hopefully,
which is a lot of sleeving if you have even just a 360-card cube. Like, you know, my 360 with 200 basics, which again is more than you probably need. That's like almost 600 cards to sit down and sleeve up, which is a lot.
Right. And if that doesn't go without saying, you do want to have all the basics sleeved up in the same sleeves as the rest of the cube. So make sure if you're, you know, ordering your sleeves to take that into account, that you're going to have both the deck and all the basic lands.
All right, Anthony, what's your kit? What's your sleeve stack? Give me your full stack.
So I at some point bought a lot of Hypermat sleeves, which has been great just to have a lot of things consistent. I can swap things between
decks.
That's
KMC brand sleeve.
Yeah, KMC sleeve. They're okay. I recommend them. Again, like you said, I think that there's not, like, they all work. Sleeves, your brand is not that critical. For my regular cube, I went a level up and went with the Ultra Pro Eclipse sleeves, and I think I've heard a little bit of negativity about them. I will say they are a little bit brittle. I've had a fair number of them split. But I think they just feel so good when you shuffle them, and I love the aesthetics of the black on the front, and I have them in white on the back, and I think they just look great.
White sleeves is asking to have a bunch of sleeves with you know, grubby players playing
your
cube.
Style has a cost.
All right, you got to do it. For me, I switched over to Dragon Shield years ago. I was originally a KMC person. I'm probably, if I had to be honest and rate how rough of a shuffler I am, I'm probably on the rougher side of 50%. I would have to imagine. You know, and so I was splitting KMC sleeves pretty regularly and getting annoyed by it. Switched over to Dragon Shields, and in the 3 or 4 years I've been using exclusively Dragon Shields on all of my cubes, all of my decks, never split a single sleeve. There is a bit of a cost. The Dragon Shields are a tiny bit thicker than most other sleeves, and annoyingly, if you're into aesthetics, they're a little bit taller than they need to be, which is just very annoying to me. Like, they could cut off a millimeter or maybe 2 millimeters off the top, and it would frame the card perfectly, but you have a little extra sleeve that kind of, like, flops around at the top, which is a little bit annoying, even if they're double-sleeved.
That bothers me, too. I wonder if that is an intentional design choice, though, so it actually doesn't sort of remain open at the top.
Could be. It could be. It could be that the engineers have, you know, talked about this issue and figured out that it's actually important to them. I am also a big champion of perfect hard inner sleeves, which are perfect fit sleeves that are a little bit thicker, or actually substantially thicker, than regular perfect inner sleeves. And I love them for a lot of reasons. One, I actually think it does have a significant impact on just keeping the card safe, both from accidentally spilling some liquid on the table or someone that's a bit of a rough shuffler, because it keeps the cards significantly stiffer than they would be in a regular perfect sleeve or not double sleeved at all. And I love the feel of those thick, thick, heavy cards. It feels premium to me. I like the thick card feel. There is a cost to that, which is that it makes your cube substantially thicker. We will link to someone who's posted a sort of breakdown of how much it changes the thickness of cards. Off the top of my head, I'm pretty sure it adds like 40% of thickness to a regular double-sleeved cube. It adds a lot.
Wow, that's actually a huge increase.
It is a big increase. So if you have your cube, you know, stored in a certain box that you like and you want to switch to perfect cards, chances are it's not going to fit in that box anymore. Or it's something to think about at the beginning. I've also dabbled with the sealable perfect sleeves, which I think KMC makes some. I think Dragon Shield also makes some. I've used the KMCs. I don't think I've done the Dragon Shields before. This is one where the perfect fit sleeve has a little flap. So you basically put the card in and then you tuck this flap over and it kind of seals it on all four sides. Some people love these, so you might be in the camp of people that really like these. I have a couple quibbles with them, but I will say they are a pretty big advantage if you're going to have double face cards and people are going to be regularly unsleeving cards out of your sleeves to look at the backside or flip it over. It's much easier to double sleeve with the sealable sleeve than it is with regular perfect fit sleeves, where it can sometimes be a little tricky to get the perfect fit sleeve and the card inside of the outer sleeve. And we won't go into details about that because there's a bazillion YouTube videos. People have talked about double sleeving ad nauseum. You can Google it if you want to read more about it. But specifically for cube owners, if you are concerned about people taking double face cards out of their sleeves, putting them back in, the resealable might be good for you. My quibbles with them, well, first of all, they don't have that thickness that I love from the perfect hards, which I'm kind of obsessed with. That my biggest quibble is that it's basically impossible in my experience, or it takes a lot of care and time to get the sleeve on and off without denting the back of the sleeve, because you have to tuck this like flap into the back of the sleeve, especially getting them off. I just find that there's no way to get my finger in there without like denting and damaging the sleeve a little bit, which not a huge deal, but it does kind of annoy me. And it takes longer to sleeve them with resealable sleeves than it does with just regular perfect sleeves.
So we're clearly advocating for consistency because we're just kind of nitpickers like that.
We have attention for detail.
Attention for detail. But I will say if that's a barrier for entry to you, maybe you just have like a couple pricier cards that you want to make sure are double sleeved and kept safe, but you don't want to take the time or the expense to double sleeve an entire cube. That honestly doesn't matter all that much, I don't think. So
no, I think it's fine. Totally fine.
I have like some novelty cubes that I don't expect we're going to be playing a lot, and we're, you know, playing pretty casually. And playing with those, I've never noticed, you know, picking up a pack or drawing a card. It's never been enough of a difference that I felt like I could, unless I was going really far out of my way to get some advantage out of that. So I don't think it's critical that you absolutely do it.
Yeah, unless you're playing your cube for like, you know, $1,000 pot, I think you don't have to worry about people trying to gain some advantage from a slightly thicker card somewhere in the deck. I had an EDH deck for a while that I put some expensive cards in, and I didn't have a box that would fit the whole deck double-sleeved in perfect hards. Again, because perfect hards make the deck a lot thicker. But I wanted these specific cards to be protected, so I put them in perfect hards, left the rest of the deck in regular perfect sleeves. And you'd really have to go out of your way to try and gain some sort of gameplay advantage based on a couple of cards being a little thicker. So totally fine to do that if you just want to get the cards down and start playing, which I think you'll find us often advocating for just getting rid of any barrier to you playing your cube. If you're like, oh, this is too much work to double sleeve, just regular sleeve, just do it.
Yeah, it'll be fine. The last biggest point about buying sleeves is buy them all at once. Go to your local game store or maybe find an online retailer and see if you can get a bunch in bulk and make sure, again, you factor in the size of the cube and your basic lands and get enough for all of them plus some extras, you know, in case you do split a sleeve or you do need that extra sleeve to sleeve up an extra basic land. And the reason
somebody
just,
gets syrup all over one of your cards, for example, you're going to want to replace that sleeve.
And the reason is there's just always going to be some inconsistency between batches. Whatever brand you prefer, you can go ahead and, you know, they'll work. They'll be good sleeves. But there is going to be some inconsistency between batches. So you don't want to end up saying, well, I have, you know, my 360 card cube that I bump up to a 540 a year down the line. And all of a sudden now I got a bunch of sleeves and they're slightly different colors or they have slightly different texture on the edges or something like that.
Well, that's a big ask, to ask people to buy an extra 180 sleeves just in case they want to make their cube a little bigger.
I'm just giving the worst case example of how you could just end up with a cube that half the sleeves look very different.
This issue, I think, is especially true if you're going for colorful sleeves. I have not found an issue with Dragon Shield black sleeves ever having any differences between them, though I do often buy in batch anyway, just because I like to buy in batches. I know I'm going to have a lot of cards to sleeve, but I have noticed it for sure on any of the colored sleeves. Basically, like each batch, they're mixing the inks and dyes when they're making that batch of sleeves or that batch of plastic, and it might not be exactly the same from set to set. Now, again, is anybody going to be able to derive any kind of competitive advantage from sleeves not quite matching? No. Especially not if, like, the cube is half and half or you have 150 cards. Like, there's no way they're going to remember, well, these set of cards have slightly more removal in them, and so I should know if the top card's slightly different. It's not going to happen. But it might annoy you, and so just also buying in bulk is just good for saving money.
This did happen one time when someone, a friend of ours who was designing a cube, they didn't get enough, and they had sleeved up the main cube, and then they went and bought, you know, another pack from the local game store or something, so like one kind of basic land was noticeably a different color, and that was a little bit tilting.
That does happen sometimes. I'm not going to advocate for this, but I do want to note that I have seen before in the cube community at least one person that just sleeved up their entire cube in completely mismatched whatever sleeves they had sitting around their used sleeve box with the logic of, well, if all these sleeves are all weird and mismatched and strange, well, what are the chances someone's going to try and remember which cards are in yellow sleeves, which cards are in white sleeves, which cards are in red sleeves, which cards are in whatever sleeves? Probably not going to matter. We're playing this thing casually anyway. So maybe that's an option for you. Maybe you want to just go full motley with it.
That would drive me insane, but I also really love it.
Yeah, it's definitely a vibe, for sure.
All right, so I kind of want to talk about sleeving tokens, but maybe we should just talk about tokens.
Yeah, let's go tokens.
So tokens are a huge part of Magic. I think every single Magic set has some tokens in it, and more than likely you're going to end up, unless you are deliberately avoiding them in your cube, which is a reasonable thing to do, to be honest.
For sure.
But you're going to end up with some cards that produce tokens. And there's a lot of different philosophies on this. Some people just will never use tokens, no matter how easy and how available they are.
I would say most players will never use tokens, much to the frustration and consternation of cube designers that have spent the time to curate them all carefully in their box.
Right. If you as the designer and most of your playgroup feels the same way that you just don't want to play with tokens, that's fine. I'm going to advocate you make sure to try and get all the tokens that actually match the cards and make them available, because it really makes gameplay so much better, especially when you're playing with cards that are less familiar and people that are maybe not as familiar with the game. Those are kind of the worst mistakes that can happen in Magic, where you attack and don't realize that somebody has an extra blocker or they have an extra mana from a treasure. These can be really frustrating situations. So if you're going to do anything as a cube designer to try and make a positive atmosphere for your players, getting the right tokens is an easy win.
Yeah, even if 90% of your players ignore them, the 10% that really care is because they want to make sure that they keep the game state very clearly communicated. It's just, I think, great to have them. Some tokens can be kind of pricey or hard to find, depending on what kind of cards you're pulling from, so that could be a potential annoyance.
Or completely non-existent, if you like Ophiomancer,
completely non-existent. There are definitely tokens that do not exist. Triplicate Titan is a new card that has tokens that don't exist from the Commander product, and Ophiomancer is a classic cube card that ends up in a lot of cubes that does not have 1/1 Snake Death Touch tokens. Which brings me to one of my favorite solutions, Anthony, which is just putting a couple of sleeved up blank cards. There were like blank cards from Strixhaven, I believe, that were designed to be some kind of illusion token or something you could just kind of fill in. But the idea is basically you sleeve up some blank cards and just put them in your box with a dry erase marker and let people kind of make tokens on the fly if they want to. You're trying to prove me wrong about the Triplicate Titan tokens. I looked for them though.
I was confused because I feel like they've been really consistent about always producing tokens for new cards, but Scryfall doesn't list any.
They don't do it for Commander products pretty often, actually.
Really?
Yeah. Specifically, commander products often don't have the tokens for the cards. That's how we got Ophiomancer. That's how we got Triplicate Titan.
I thought that was specifically, like, the first commander product did not. And since then, they've not only had tokens, but had nice double-sided tokens.
I don't know what to tell you. Triplicate Titan was printed last year. No tokens. To be fair, it makes three different golems, which is kind of annoying. That'd be a lot of tokens to print.
They knew what they were doing. They could have done a better job.
So, dry erase, blank tokens, I think, are great. Or if you have just a stack of blank tokens from the Strixhaven or whatever, just let people draw on them with a Sharpie and then put them in your box, draw on them with a Sharpie, and then you have that token forever now.
Yeah, even more than, you know, making proxies for actual Magic cards, making proxies for tokens is completely reasonable. And a lot of people do all kinds of fun things with them, even for tokens where there isn't, I feel like it's not even correct to say a real version, but...
Yeah, like a officially licensed product. Right.
A lot of people, you know, have cool Etsy shops with all kinds of neat tokens, so it's definitely possible to find them.
Yeah, you can definitely find some artists out there that make their own tokens. There's various Kickstarters and stuff going on from time to time, so if you want to really have a cool token box, that's also achievable.
How do you store your tokens?
This is always a challenge, and I don't love my solution, but what I do right now is I sleeve my tokens based on the color of the token itself. So if it's a colorless token, an emblem or whatever, it gets like a gray sleeve. If it's a color, it gets a sleeve of the appropriate color. I have gold sleeves for gold tokens. I do all of this, and then I try and put the tokens inside. I have boxes for my basic lands. Again, we'll get to storage. And I put my tokens inside with the basics that come from the card that produced those tokens. So in my green box, I have clue tokens for Tireless Tracker, even though clue tokens are colorless. But you can tell they're colorless because they stand out. The sleeves a little bit different in the box. I do all of this work and I try and think about this complicated system, and ultimately people just mostly ignore the tokens, or they go looking for them in the colorless box. I actually try and put them in both places sometimes, have extra tokens around so the colorless tokens are both in the colorless box and also in the box that corresponds to the card that creates them. But it ends up being complicated. My cube has a ton of tokens. I mean, if you don't pay attention to trying to specifically limit your token types, I think I have, I don't know, a couple dozen different kinds of tokens, and some of them I need a decent quantity of. And so it ends up being a pretty daunting pile of tokens to dig through to find whatever you're looking for.
So just to reinforce that, you're saying you have each kind of token in different color sleeves that are also distinct from the main color sleeves that the rest of the cube is in.
Correct, yeah. My cube is in black sleeves, and for black cards, I use purple sleeves, basically, to separate them.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I think that's just a great way to both make it easy to not lose the tokens when you shuffle them up into a deck or something like that.
Yeah, that's an important thing to mention. I hate when tokens are sleeved in the same sleeve as the deck or cube, and you have to remember...
Halfway through, you draw a token that's...
and then you get banned from the DCI, and you can't play cube anymore.
And of course, like anything else, you can just choose not to sleeve the tokens or, you know, not have tokens at all. Yeah. That's totally up to you. A lot of people don't care about them as much, and that's completely reasonable. But I think for all those reasons and keeping things nice and tidy and everything sort of feel the same in the box, I think it is nice to do that.
I want to mention one more thing about tokens, which is, I think, counts as a logistic thing that starts to edge a little bit on cube design. I think there's a lot of value in trying to eliminate very small differences between tokens if you can, especially if that has an impact on gameplay. The most annoying example I can point to is that there are cards in Magic's history that produce 1/1 white human soldier tokens. Great, lots of them, in fact. It's a very common token. There are also cards in Magic's history that produced white 1/1 soldier tokens that are not humans. And if you have a card that cares about creature types in your cube, you know, an heirloom blade, a gem razor with mutate, and you can't mutate onto a human, it's very likely that the person that is pulling those tokens out of the box for their Elspeth or whatever is not going to have enough attention to detail to note whether they're taking the human or the non-human tokens, and that can become potentially confusing in the future. So be aware of that. That can happen sometimes where tokens are almost identical, but they're actually not identical, and if that difference does make a gameplay difference in your cube, that can be a lot to keep track of and pretty annoying.
I'm really satisfied in my new battle box that I've gotten my... It took a lot of effort, but I've gotten myself down to only 3 unique types of tokens, and I think that's going to just make the whole thing so much easier.
Yeah, I have a clean cube list I've been dabbling with just on the side. Every time I see a card that I think is like nice and clean design, I stick it in the clean cube. It's kind of inspired by our conversations about how any kind of additional text or stuff on the card that isn't actually really relevant to what's going on actually does create a lot of confusion and complexity that is hard to track, and it makes the game less enjoyable and harder to make strategic decisions. And in that cube, I'm conscious of trying to not make an extraneous number of tokens, and it's so hard. It's so
really
much
hard,
harder than you might think it is. You've never tried to do it. You're like, oh yeah, this card's great. Oh wait, that does make a token, actually. And now do I really want that to be the only card that makes that token, or do I want 2 different kinds of white tokens that are both 1/1s? Like, it gets really, really challenging to actually keep that all under control.
Yeah, I'm just like looking at this battle box and I'm like, I really like Ancestral Blade and I really like Barb Spike. I think they're perfect for this, but do I really want to add two different unique kinds of tokens?
Right, exactly. Anything else on tokens? If you can figure out how to get your players to use them, please write into the show and tell me, because I as a player, I kind of force my opponents to use the correct tokens if they're available, because I have been burned so many times by there's just an upside down card on the table and I forget that that's actually a dumb token that was made by a spell five turns ago and I attack and they're like, a block, and it's like, this is stupid.
Yeah, again, it doesn't usually matter. And if you're playing with skilled players, they can often just keep track of it.
Oh, burn, Anthony. Oh, burn!
They can
roasted.
Often keep track with it. But I just want to emphasize that that small percentage of the times where you can't is some of the worst magic experience you can have. So yeah. I would just recommend also to all of us as players, we do our best to get the tokens. I know I'm often, you know, if I see people laying out their decks before a draft and I'm going and finding my own basic lands, I'll start grabbing and throwing the tokens to people just to hopefully get them to play with them.
Yeah.
I know listener Sky as well has been doing some work on trying to come up with a system to get players, or, you know, just to make it as easy as possible to get players to play with their tokens. So
yeah, I think there's an impending article about that, so stay tuned for Sky's great article. What's next, Anthony? I think we covered tokens pretty holistically.
Never. I love tokens. I could talk about them all day.
Tokens are fun, though I will say, as a cube designer, it is frustrating when you have to deal with different types of tokens that are mechanically identical. It's like, oh, I got...
It's true.
1-1 monk tokens and 1-1 warrior tokens and 1-1 soldier tokens.
And spirits.
Hooray.
And black-white spirits. And
oh, the spirits that don't
spirits
fly?
Spirits that don't fly.
Spirits that don't fly? Don't even get me started. I understand why Magic does it. It's great to have that additional flavor of the plane that you're in. As somebody who is trying to build a format that is agnostic of the set cards are initially printed in, it can be an annoyance. I still love them.
That's a weird tension because I also feel that, but I also just think that they're like a really fun piece of paraphernalia, and it's actually part of like constructing a cube and putting it in the box and having all the different colored sleeves is disproportionately satisfying to me.
Yeah.
Let's talk about cube storage. I feel like this is the next biggest thing where it's like, well, I've got my cards together, I've got them sleeved up, but I need to take them to the shop or I want to, you know, put them on a shelf somewhere.
We have very different approaches to cube storage, Anthony.
Yeah, I'm looking at some cube boxes right now, and I think that's fair to say.
Why don't you go first? Tell people how you store your cube.
So my main cube is stored in plain white BCW 600 count boxes. I've got one box, which is
the cardboard
just,
ones, folks. The ones made of cardboard.
Cardboard. They're dirt cheap. You know, go to your LGS and say, "Can I have some of these dirt cheap boxes?" And they'll say, "No problem." I have one box that's mostly cube cards and another box that has all the lands, tokens, as well as some extra sleeves and a little bit of overflow from the main cube. I definitely invested a little bit, not a ton, but some more in some past cube projects. And similarly, you know, I know myself. I know that my interests in Magic have continued to evolve and change. So just not spending a bunch on a cube box and saying, well, this works well for now. If I want to make my cube twice as big in, you know, 3 years from now or 1 year from now, I know I'm not committed to any specific size. They're also easy to replace, and I feel like just that size of box happens to fit well in a lot of bags.
Yeah, and you know, your cubes are somewhat valuable. It's not like your cubes are all super cheap, but unless you are like throwing this in like a bag you're gonna like put on a plane or something, I don't think you have to worry about the cards becoming damaged in these cardboard boxes. They're sufficiently stored.
It's a balance between also I like them because they're also very small. You know, it's not a thick box that takes up a lot of extra space, and that portability is valuable to me, but it is sort of inverse to durability.
I have my main cube in a very expensive custom-made wooden box built by Aaron Kane, which, you know, I mean, it's just an indulgence. I did it because I like my cube. I like thinking about it. I like playing with it. I wanted it to feel special. And so I got a fancy box to make it feel special. Mine is a little bit custom. It's not an off-the-shelf option. Maybe I'll, like, do a quick video about it at some point just so people can see what I'm working with.
Yeah, I'll do a video about mine, too.
Like, actually pretty funny if we posted back-to-back videos on the YouTube channel of you being like, yeah, so here's my BCW cardboard. I think these are, you know, $4 each about.
I've got a foam insert to fill up extra space. Yeah. Keeps it tight.
Yeah. And so, I mean, there's lots of great custom wood options out there if you want to go really over the top. I know some players have a custom wood box and they have a custom built, like, padded foam lockable case. They put that wood box in because they don't want their box to get damaged when they're traveling with it, which is kind of next level.
Wow. That's like five times sleeve your
cube.
Yeah,
exactly. That's like quad sleeving your cube, basically, if you're going that far. There's a deep well of money you can spend on fancy storage if that's what you're into. It's definitely not necessary, obviously, and my cube box, despite its expense, is not the best for travel. It's very heavy. It's very bulky. So I do have a backpack that it fits in, and I do drop it in there and walk around with it from time to time.
It fits in, meaning that's all that fits in the bag at one time?
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, it's pretty much the whole thing that fits in the bag. So yeah, those are kind of the two ends of the spectrum you can possibly explore. There's a lot of stuff in the middle. For my other smaller cubes and battle boxes, I use Ultimate Guard Archive 400s, which are like single row boxes that can fit in a sort of modular way, lots of different other deck boxes that Ultimate Guard makes. You can take Boulder deck boxes, the sort of plastic clamshell ones, and stick them in there. You can get a Xeno skin, magnetic, you know, foldy over deck box, and that'll fit in there as well. And so I really like that whole system. I'm kind of in the Ultimate Guard family of products for my stuff. They make a 550 card box called the Super Hive. So that's definitely an option if you want some nicer storage, but you're not ready to go all the way to like fancy custom box. I know a lot of people also really like the Dex Protection Supreme game chest. That's very similar, I think, to the Super Hive, just a sort of different brand. And then I'll just shout out a good budget option. KMC makes a box that they call the KMC 1000 or KMC 1000 Count Barrier Box. It's a very simple plastic box that just fits 1,000 single sleeve cards, 700 double sleeve cards. It's got a couple little dividers in there that you can put your basics or tokens in or something. So it does have a little bit of interior structure, but it's very compact, very, very cheap. It's like 12, 15 bucks. You can get it for almost nothing. I used that for years before I upgraded to my big fancy box.
That was a big jump.
It was a big jump. I will say to anybody that is maybe exploring fancy storage options, and this is probably not the episode for you because this is covering all the basic logistics, and if you're looking to spend a bunch of money on a fancy box, you probably already have that stuff sorted out. But I will say that I was very glad that when I got my box, I intentionally made it bigger than I needed it to be to hold my cube, because I was like, if I make my cube bigger, I don't want to outgrow this box. That will be very annoying to me. And there's all kinds of reasons I can imagine you want to make the cube bigger in the future. So that was something I am glad that I did. I made the cube the box bigger than it needed to be, and I filled up that space with extra storage for dice and stuff like that to make it nice and tight when the cards are in there. But that is definitely something you should maybe consider if you're going to go that route.
So anything along the spectrum is reasonable and works. The questions are just, how much do you value durability, portability, and aesthetics, really? Do you want to be the person bringing out that big mahogany box and having the spectacle of hearing that perfect little snap of the magnets coming off? Or are you fine just having a plain white box that you know you have a lot of flexibility with in the future?
I'm a bougie bitch. What can I say?
There's nothing wrong with that.
Also want to touch on other parts of storage. Is not just the big box you need. I think some people often want to know, how should I store my basics with my cube? And there's a couple of different approaches to this. I'm picturing like the sort of, you know, chaotic neutral, chaotic good, you know, lawful evil like grid. And one approach is just putting all of your basics all mixed up together just in a big pile. Some people really prefer this option, which just allows you to basically say, here's all the basics, just grab a stack, pull out the ones you need, put the stack back when you're done. That's definitely the chaotic side of the spectrum, but you can definitely do that. I like sorting my basics, which serves a couple of functions. One, obviously, if you know you're a green-white deck, you know where to find the green and white basics very quickly, which is nice. The other thing is, it helps me visually make sure that everybody has taken their basics out of their deck at the end, because I can see that I have the same amount in separate little piles, which I think is a little bit of a nice touch. And then I actually put all of my basics with the tokens produced by cards of that color into separate little deck boxes. So I have little plastic Boulder deck boxes that fit into my fancy custom wood box that it's easy to pass around the table. People can, you know, pass the stack of swamps with all the black tokens very easily, which I think is a relatively nice system.
Yeah, it does work pretty well.
Yeah, as the man with the cardboard box, he's like, yeah, it's fine, I guess.
It takes
like,
up a lot of space.
You've thought about it a lot, and it's fine.
On the other side of the spectrum, I just take them all out of the box, put them in a stack. Hopefully, if there's, you know, a second table where people can go and grab their basics, inevitably people just say, hey, can I get two swamps from whoever happens to be standing up? And it works out fine.
Yeah. Some people are big fans of Cubamajigs, and there is a competing product made by Dragon Shield that I forget what it's called, but you can find it on Google. I'll put it in the show notes, which is basically little tiny sort of plastic boxes that are meant to hold just the number of cards that basically go into a pack. So 15 double sleeve cards, maybe more if they're single sleeved or not unsleeved. And the idea here is that you would basically build these packs ahead of time, and then when you go to Cube Draft, you just take the packs right out of the box, and it kind of simulates the feeling of opening up an actual booster pack. I've never done the Cube Magic thing. It seems a little... I mean, even though I'm the guy with the fancy wood box, and I explained my weird, complicated system with the land boxes and the tokens, it seems a little finicky for me, and I'm not excited about having to, like, put them all back in little boxes to store them for later, because then where do the boxes go if you put the cards back in the... Like, it seems like a little bit too finicky for me.
But I put the little boxes in a bigger box. I don't think that's really a problem.
But I know a lot of Cube designers do really like them, and so that is something you should be aware of as an option.
Yeah, I think, again, it's just consider the motivation for it and why you're doing it. I think that there's it's a great reason, too, if you really want to minimize sort of the pickup, the, like, at-the-moment preparation. So, you know, imagine you're going to be playing at the LGS. You know you're going to get there right when they open, and you want to be ready to go. Or maybe you do, like, special pack collation, and you want to make sure, like, a certain kind of card gets one into each pack.
That's a great point. If you're doing special pack collation, I think it makes a huge difference to have.
Yeah.
So, like, if I had a set cube, for example, I'd be much more interested in something like Cube Majigs. Not only because I wouldn't expect to play the set cube as much as I play my regular cube, but if it comes out once every couple months, then the additional work to get it all sleeved up and put in these little boxes is not as much. And also then you could actually, you know, put the rares and uncommons, call it your pack as you wanted to, and have it ready to go.
And that experience of just taking the time to shuffle up the cube and then collate it, or, you know, build packs, whatever, in whatever way you do, could also just be a fun experience for you just to, like, touch
maybe
all your
like
cards.
To touch all your magic cards.
Maybe you like to touch all your magic cards. It's a good time to listen to a podcast. So I think for a lot of people that does make a lot of sense. Another reason that I personally am not interested in is I know I'm going to play my cube in all kinds of different ways. We're going to do a draft with eight
right.
people. We're going to do a draft
exactly.
with four people, and I want different pack sizes. We're going to do a grid draft. So doing all that prep work would just sort of be counterproductive for me.
Yeah, if you pack them all up in their little boxes and then we're like, time to do a grid draft. I guess I got to take 9 cards out of each of these packs, and, like, it's going to be a kind of a nightmare. So that's definitely a reason to maybe avoid that.
But they're really cool products, and I'm just actually excited to see people making stuff specifically for cubes.
Yeah, that is very cool. And they had a Kickstarter very recently that has been enormously successful, which speaks volumes, I think, to the cube community, which is exciting.
Let's talk a little bit about shuffling. I have pretty strong feelings about shuffling. So I'll present how most people shuffle. Is they take out the cube, it's probably unshuffled, they have a bunch of stacks on the table, they say, hey, help me shuffle, you take a couple packs and do a little shuffling, and then maybe hand me half of that, and things kind of get passed around, and this is fine, this works for most people.
Doesn't sound like you think it's fine.
But I have this anxiety about, well, you've been over there shuffling, you know, 60 cards, and you haven't really been passing them around with other people as much more, so there's this little pocket of red cards that aren't getting
mixed
up.
It's like the opposite of COVID anxiety. You're like, everybody's got to mix up.
Right, everybody has to
stop isolating.
Everybody got to mix up perfectly. So the way I like to shuffle my cube is I do like to, after the draft, you know, I've got the whole cube with me, sit down, like I said, I'll put on a podcast, and
perhaps some Bunta Vista,
maybe a magic podcast. Let's be honest, I'm probably listening to drive to work. So what I like to do is
nerd.
My cube is about 400 cards, so if I just split it into four piles, it's about the size of a commander deck. I'll take each of those four piles, do a quick riffle shuffle, really like two or three.
A quiffle shuffle.
Two or three riffles, because I'm not done shuffling. I don't need that pile to be perfectly mixed. I'll do that with all four, then cut them all into four and mix those four. So now each new stack of four contains one quarter from each of the original four. It's actually pretty quick to do, because you can really easily just grab the top half of a stack and then the top half of those two substacks. And that way you can be confident. If you imagine, well, there's a stack of red cards at the bottom of one of those original four piles, it gets uniformly distributed in the first quadrant, and then
yes, uniformly distributed, the best kind of shuffling.
Yeah, that's what the best kind of shuffling is, right? We just
want to
get
the best kind
really
of shuffling
random.
Is randomized, not uniformly distributed.
Uniform random is what I'm trying to say.
Okay.
And I'll just do that process like three times. Andy's going to make it sound a little complicated, but this really takes... I've timed
myself.
No,
I'm sure it's not that complicated.
It takes 5 minutes. And then I just have no anxiety about, was there a stack of cards that didn't make it in that complicated shuffling? It's all done. It's all good. And I can just deal out packs.
Yeah. I don't take shuffling maybe as seriously as you, but I do something ultimately kind of similar. I will take my cube out of the box and put it in some number of piles. I don't make it four necessarily. I just actually probably do many more piles, because my cube is in perfect cards and therefore is much thicker. You would not be able to riffle shuffle 100 perfect card double sleeve cards. It would be much too bulky. So I put it in some number of piles. And then what I like to do is basically shuffle as I'm making packs. Usually, I don't make packs ahead of time, like I said, in the Cube and Majig sense. But if I'm going to host a draft, I will try to make the actual packs and have them on the table for people when they show up.
Right.
And so I like to shuffle as I'm building the packs, which basically is take all the cards out of the box, put them in piles, and then take a little bit from each pile, riffle them together, and then use that to distribute one card in each pack across table in front of you. And what you've ultimately done is, like, even if one pile had a bunch of red cards in it, you've shuffled them together with other piles, and then you've distributed them somewhat evenly among the packs. And I feel like that's 100% random enough for me. So I don't do any conscious
random
shuffling.
Enough for him.
Well, here's the other thing I'll say. People oftentimes will open up a cube pack and be like, what the heck? This is, someone messed up the shuffling. It's not random because there's a bunch of red cards in here.
Right.
That's not how random works.
It can still
be completely random and have a pack full of red cards. In fact, I would argue if that never happens, it's not actually that random.
Right.
Which is important to bring up because if you're trying to emulate what Wizards does with booster packs are not random. They are correlated in sophisticated, complicated ways that ultimately end up feeling somewhat random, but I'm pretty sure in modern Magic sets, as in everything printed in the past 15, 20 years, you are always going to get a card of each color in every pack, and you're never going to get 9 blue cards and then one green, one red, one black, one white. They do some kind of collation to basically have some preset diversity in that pack. Now, some cube designers have developed more complicated shuffling methods to actually emulate this. I want to talk about one that is from Reddit user Moco, which I have used before a couple times because I was interested in it. And I think it works great. And basically, the way that this shuffling method works is you're going to basically try and randomly shuffle the cube with some accommodation given to distributing the colors somewhat evenly. I'm not actually going to walk through the entire shuffling process here because it's kind of complicated. It'll be hard to follow in audio. I'll link it in the show notes. It basically amounts to separating the cube by colors first, shuffling the colors all up, and then taking like half-ish of the cube and distributing those kind of by color and having the rest be done randomly. You basically like...
So it's mostly an even distribution, but there's some randomness. So you're likely to get a couple cards of every color, but you're not going to get exactly 1-2 cards of each color and a gold card and a colorless card, for example.
Yeah, basically like you have... You separate the cube by color first, and then you shuffle in a little bit of other cards. Like, you basically take a little bit off each top and then shuffle some of that pile into every pile. So each stack is not all green cards, all blue cards anymore. It's mostly green cards, mostly blue cards, but with some number of random cards shuffled in. Which means that technically it is still possible to get a pack with no green cards, though it's extremely, extremely, extremely unlikely, just statistically. So it's just a different kind of random that attempts to distribute the colors a little more reasonably. I think it's a good approach. The way that Moco has laid this out is easy to follow when you see it in writing. Not that time-consuming to do, actually. The hardest part is just getting the cube separated at first because you have to get it all into the separate colors immediately. Once you have it there, it's not that much longer than regular shuffling to get it into this sort of style of pack. And if you're concerned about that, you can do it. The times I've done it, I have not felt any kind of difference. You know, actually, one time I did it, I specifically saw like a bunch of green cards in the pack by like pick 4, and I was like, well, I did the shuffling method. There wouldn't be this many green cards left if players had taken green cards. And players had taken green cards because it is still random, and so there were just other green cards in that pack by pure luck.
Yeah, I mean, the goal of that shuffling method, to be clear, is people want to replicate that experience of a normal draft with sealed packs where you can read signals very well, because if you see a bunch of red cards in the pack, you know that it's much less likely that there was just a pack full of red cards. And I think that's a reasonable goal for me personally. And again, going back to, I mean, it's just a value proposition. Do you really want to put that much effort to have that slight advantage to your draft experience? Or is it more valuable to you just to make the shuffling experience faster and uniform random is good enough for, the variety of different formats you're playing?
Yeah, and actually the times I've done it, maybe this will be a nice segue into the next topic here. The times I've done it, I've actually been times where I already had the cube separated by color, and I was like, well, I might as well at this point. Like,
yeah, that makes sense.
And basically, I was doing that when I was doing a sort of full survey of the cube to make sure I had all my cards, usually because I miscounted or had misplaced a card somehow, which does occasionally happen. I'm not sure what the title of this section, Anthony, but how do we talk about the logistics of making sure all your cube is exactly the cards you think it is, and no more, no less?
Oh, wow. You know, that's not even a topic I noted. That's interesting. For me, again, because I have this sort of floating size of cube, I just don't know, I guess, because I'm not dealing out.
What are the chances if you did a full survey of your cube, it would not match your cube Cobra list exactly?
So I think I actually feel pretty good about it because I am pretty careful about when I make an update. I, you know, keep the list of adds and cuts and make sure I don't check them off until I actually make it. So even if I don't have my digital list perfectly in sync with my in paper list, I have a clear record of what needs to come in and come out. And I'm pretty have a lot of attention to detail for that. And I did recently also do some sorting just to, you know, do some other things with my cube, and at least noticed that a lot of the pricier cards were all still there. So I won't say I was surprised by that, but I was heartened.
Yeah, I mean, some people do worry about their cards disappearing when they're drafting with people. And yeah. I can understand the anxiety, especially if you have valuable cards. I won't pretend like I've never had a thought of, like, let's just make sure my Gaia's Cradle is still in this box because it would be nice to see it again. You know, like, that, those thoughts have crossed my mind. But in general, like, I only play with people I trust and would not expect to try and rob me, basically. And I also don't play my cube in, like, a crowded public area. I'll play in the LGS. We, you know, we have our little corner to ourselves and we'll play the cube down there. But I'm not going to, like, go to a restaurant, you know, with a bunch of people around and, like, have people drafting the cube and dropping cards on the floor and stuff.
Oh, I will 100% do that. That's a great advantage to having a mostly pretty budget cube.
Yeah, I'll be happy to play your cube at the...
The Crown.
I'll be happy to play your cube at the Crown, exactly. Here's what I'll say about trying to keep track of things. If you are worried about it, you can just make sure that... Tell every player before the draft, like, hey, you're going to have 45 cards after the draft. You're responsible for handing me 45 cards when you leave.
Right.
You can count them if you want. I personally would not play a cube with people I didn't trust so much. And it's important to know, it might not be stealing. It could just be misplacing, dropping it on, right, on the floor, you know, whatever. But if you want to do that, you can do it. I personally, it's too much work for me to, like, do that. But that's, I think, the easiest way to make sure you get your cards back after a draft. And then when inevitably, and maybe you're better at this than me, Anthony, and better than most cube designers I've talked to, I think it's inevitable that you will eventually realize there is some incongruity between your digital online list and your actual cube in paper. And when that happens, you just kind of got to sit down and count them all and figure it out.
Sort the cube.
I mean, usually you can, if it happened recently, you can look at your most recent changes and, like, make sure that you actually cut all the cards you thought you cut or added all the cards you thought you added. But in my case, I had one time where there was a 361st card in my cube for many, many months over the pandemic where I wasn't playing it as much, or when I was playing it, it was just grid drafting.
Drafts, yeah.
And it turned out it was just an abrupt decay that I thought I had, that I did cut digitally, but didn't mean to cut digitally. And so I kept seeing it in the cube in paper and being like, yeah, of course, Abrupt Decay's in here. I love that card. And then I'd actually, like, cut it for testing at an earlier set. It doesn't matter how this happens, but it does happen. And sometimes you just have to count your whole cube. And so when you do that, it's oftentimes easy to, like, just separate them out by color and then make sure you have the right number of each color to find whatever card is missing or additional. That's much easier than just kind of, like, looking at them all and trying to figure out which card is out of place. Because if you say, all right, well, here are my green cards. I know there's 39. There's 39 in the cube. Let's assume that that's all right. You can find the color, at least, that it's in to sort of get to the bottom of what card is extra or missing. And then once you've done that, if you do want to try the shuffling method, that's a great time to do it because your cube is already divided by color, which is the hardest part of that shuffling method. And then you can just kind of go ahead and shuffle them up and make nice packs.
Yeah, it makes sense. Should we take it for granted that everybody keeps a digital list of their cube?
No, we should not, Anthony. How do you keep a digital list of your cube?
Well, I mean, I was taking it for granted. And as soon as you explained this, I was like, well, maybe some people don't. And I'm actually, I think I can think of some people who do just, you know, lay out the cube. They put the cards they want in the pile and sleeve them up.
I wish my brain would allow me to do that.
I think that's fine, but it's also just really nice to have a digital list. I really love spreadsheets. For this, of course, I'm using CubeCobra, the premier cube website that lets you keep a digital list as well as do a lot of analysis and stuff on it. I would definitely recommend it. It also makes it really easy to share the list and talk about it with other people.
It is really nice to have a list to share, even right. If you're not like a, I care about drafting my cube digitally, simulated on CubeCobra, and I'm going to, like, meticulously write blog posts about my updates. You don't have to care about any of that. If you want to be able to send people a link to your list because they're going to play your cube, it's really great to have it on a cube website rather than in some, like, deck management website, which I see pretty often. Like, we kind of glossed over CubeCobra. CubeCobra is a website that is designed specifically for managing your cube. It is a zillion times better than using any other kind of deck or magic card management software and trying to use it to sort to organize a cube. It has a lot of features, and just the way it displays the cube on the screen is just way better than trying to look at it on Scryfall's deck editor or Tapped Out or Deckbox, whatever you're using.
Yeah, I would really feel that absence if I was going to go to a cube draft and the owner didn't have a list to share that we could just browse beforehand. I think that would definitely have an impact on my draft experience.
My favorite is when they're like, here's the list, but I've changed like 30 or 40 cards and it's not updated on digitally yet. It's like, okay, well.
I mean, even then, it usually gives you enough of a sense of what's
that's
going
true.
On.
You can always figure out the overall thrust of what they're trying to accomplish. We should mention Cube Tutor probably, because if you're new to Cube and Googling around, you will probably find some Cube Tutor links. That is an older Cube management website that has since been largely abandoned and no longer maintained. I don't want to use too strong of language, but the site has not seen updates in a very long time, and eventually the community grew tired enough of waiting for updates that KubeCobra came along and began to exist. So KubeCobra is what you should be using if you are looking to manage your kube list.
So the last topic that I have here is actually organizing the draft. I feel like there's a couple logistical things around that. We did a whole episode about, you know, finding a playgroup and hosting drafts and things like that, but there's a couple more basic things to cover, I think.
Hit me.
So the first is obviously just showing up with your cube shuffled and ready to go. So whether that means you have it in Cubamajigs or it's just shuffled and you have scheduled in time for yourself to deal out packs and have, you know, a stack of three at 90-degree angles packs for each player, just be prepared to do that.
Yeah. And it's worth noting, too, you can make packs ahead of time even if you don't have Cubamajigs and all that kind of stuff set up.
Totally.
You just put them face-to-face in the box, right? So 15 cards face-to-face with another 15 cards and then back-to-back with the next 15 cards. And they can fit in any box that holds the cards. You just have them turned basically based on how the packs are made up.
Right. That or dividers. There's plenty of ways you can have that sort of, again, do that work beforehand. The other thing I'll mention is just before the draft, make sure you're clear to your players about the rules. Are there any custom things that they should be aware of? Are there expectations you have, again, about like, you better hand me 45 cards back? Something that I really like to tell my players is after the draft, take your deck and your sideboard. Don't worry about taking any basic lands or anything out. Just put them face to face and hand that back to me. And I think this comes with a couple great advantages. It just simplifies the whole sort of wind down of the draft a lot, where people don't have as many questions about, do you want the basic lands here? Do you want this shuffled? Would I do my tokens? It's just,
do you want a picture of my deck?
One action, yeah. It also then gives you the advantage of later you can go back and look at the decks if you want to, which can be nice to sort of assess, was there, you know, are there card decks that are overperforming or underperforming, or do you just want to see what was winning and take pictures and document that experience?
Yeah.
The last thing it does is it does give you a little bit of accountability. When you have decks still together, you know, okay, well, somebody drafted this deck. If your Gaia's Cradle is not in that deck where you knew that player was playing it, you know, I don't think for most people that's going to be an issue, but I think that for a player handing you back a deck that is intact, it does just sort of have that feel expectation that it's all going
to
be there.
Right. And again, I hope there's not any kind of theft we have to worry about amongst our listeners or any of our local play group. But I think much more likely is like, I had a card just got misplaced, right? It ended up in my sideboard, or ended up in my opponent's sideboard, or my opponent Oblivion ringed it and then shuffled it into their deck after the last game. And so like, that's the other thing that could potentially happen. And so just asking for main deck and sideboard, you can pretty quickly see, this is 40 cards, this is the rest of the cards, and at least get a baseline level of like, I got my cards back, you know?
Obviously, the disadvantage or advantage, depending on who you are, is then you have things in a pretty disorganized state where you have to go through and take all these decks apart, take tokens out, potentially take the basic lands out and shuffle it. So that could be value to you, but that could also just be extra work where you'd rather say, hey, you know, players, please make sure you sort out the tokens and sort out the basic lands and give things back in like a more shuffled state. So either way is reasonable, just depends on your needs and goals. I really like having that experience also of just, yeah, being able to glance through the decks and shuffle things up. So for me, that works pretty well.
I guess I want to briefly mention here that if you're interested in much more carefully tracking the decks your players draft from your cube with hopes of learning something from them, we have an article on our website written by one of our contributors, Jet, that is all about tracking your own drafts and analyzing the data and getting some value out of it. There's a lot of potential pitfalls and things people think make a lot of sense that don't actually make a ton of sense. So I would recommend reading that article if you are interested in that. For me, I don't track deck lists that are drafted in paper at all. Obviously, I have the sort of full record of ones that are drafted digitally, either on Draforft, which is dr4ft.info, which is a website that allows you to draft remotely, which is very nice. Has an integration with KubeCobra. You can pull your list in immediately. I have those lists, but in paper drafts, I don't keep track of those lists anymore. I've been taking a couple photos of decks that are notable just for my own benefit. It's really qualitative for me. I'm just looking at it and just saying like, did this feel good? Like, what happened to this deck? Why did it fail? Did they not get cards we needed that were essential? Did this player try and draft too many colors or whatever? Like, I'll look at the decks and just try and learn what I can qualitatively, but I'm not personally interested in like any kind of quantitative analysis of my draft decks.
Right. I mean, those kind of debrief conversations are honestly part of the most fun part of Cube for me, where we get to talk about, okay, well, you felt like you drafted a pretty good, let's say, a control deck, but you really didn't have sources of card advantage. So even though you had the right interaction, you ended up in these sort of attrition wars where you fell behind. Like, those kinds of conversations just let us improve as players and improve the cube. And that's where so much of the fun to me is. So having some sense, some way to refer to those deck lists can often be very helpful.
What else? Did we cover everything finally?
I think we covered, so the last thing I have is proxies, and we also mentioned double face cards. I don't know if I want to talk about either of those things.
Proxies are fine. You're allowed to play them in Cube. It's great. No one's going to arrest you. So do that if you want to do it. My big recommendation on proxies is just for your own sanity, make sure they do not look anything like actual Magic cards, so they cannot possibly be mistaken for a forgery. The obvious way to do that is just to make the back something totally different. I have in big red letters the word proxy across the back of all the proxies I've had printed. That's an easy way to do it. Or you can use different card fronts that don't match the official Wizards of the Coast branded Magic products to make sure that you are not confusing anybody.
This ended up being a lot of little topics. I think
this is longer than I thought it was going to be.
A little more than I expected. I think overall, just what I would underscore is that in all of these topics, how you're storing your cube, how you're sleeving your cube, if you are at all, how you have tokens, and all these questions, there's no right answer. It depends on your values. Are you seeking portability and durability and speed and ease, or do you really want to take the time to, luxuriate in a lot of these aspects? So just consider what your goals are and make the choice that makes the most sense for you. And ultimately, I really want to underscore that I just want to see more people play Cube. So whatever you can do to eliminate barriers for yourself and make it easier for you to just get the Cube together and start playing, do that.
Yeah, absolutely. I will say that I have never seen a new Cube designer, in my experience, not go far enough in terms of all these logistics. Usually they go overboard. They think they have to have the right box. They have to get a perfectly matching sleeves that come from the same run of whatever sleeves. They have to double sleeve everything and perfect cards, whatever. I've seen people oftentimes go overboard because they're intimidated by the process of making a cube. They want to get all this stuff quote unquote right. And I would much rather people put their cube in mismatched motley sleeves, throw them in Ziploc bags, and have a cube they can actually play with people than let any of these things be a barrier to you actually starting to play. So I do want to underscore that at the end. Just play Cube, and all these things are, I think, optional ways you can make things a little bit easier or just grease the wheels of playing your Cube a little bit, but none of these are really necessary. So
I think I would panic if I saw somebody hold up a Ziploc bag full of mismatched sleeves and here's the Cube.
Ready to Cube draft?
I would love to see that.
I did see on Twitter this week there is a Magic player who used to be a buyer for a big sort of card reseller, and they had a pet project of theirs over the years, which was to collect already damaged versions of cards for this Gonti EDH deck. And so the idea was this deck is going to be played unsleeved, it's going to be stored in a Ziploc bag, and they just wanted to get sort of the nicest versions of these cards. They're all original printings where possible, so it's like 20 or 30 alpha swamps in this deck that are like all messed up and beaten up and damaged. And I really just love that they embraced the thing. Just go get the damaged cards, make them playable. I thought it was very charming and I was drawn to it.
I appreciate that as well.
That was longer than I thought, but I think we covered a lot of good ground and I don't think we wasted too much time just shooting the breeze.
Talking about Moby Dick?
Yeah, but just at the beginning. So thanks for tuning in to Lucky Paper Radio. If this is your first episode and you are thinking of making a cube, welcome. It's the best kind of magic to play, in my own personal opinion. And we have many, many hours of podcast backlogs to back up this assertion. So if you liked listening to this and you want to build your own cube, the next place I would point you, we do have an episode about how and why to build a cube. We'll link that in the show notes. We also have a great article written by one of our contributors about the first four questions a cube designer should ask. If you're approaching cube for the first time and you're trying to get into this world, those are some great places to get your footing.
For sure.
But that's it for this week. So thanks for tuning in. All of our music is produced by DJ James Nasty. All the magic cards are produced by Wizards of the Coast. Anthony and I are coming at you live from his basement in Baltimore, as we always do. Thanks for talking about magic with me, Anthony.
Thanks for talking about magic with me, Andy. You want to go play some magic?
A little bit, yeah.
Okay.